definite.
All right, I think we'd like to get started, if we may. Thank you, all of you, so much for coming this evening. My name is Kate Powers. I'm the Student Event Coordinator for the Women of Cinematic Arts. Some of you may have never heard of the Women of Cinematic Arts because we're a pretty new baby organization. We're women of cinematic arts. It's really hard, so sit with that for a second. Alumni and students, so basically if you're a student at this school, women can be members of Women of Cinematic Arts, but we also have a friend list for friends of Women of Cinematic Arts, which if you're here, you are. And I'd like to give you an email that you can write to if you'd like to join the organization. Phoebe is our membership coordinator. We are a Yahoo group. We are organized as a mailing list through Yahoo, but that whole world is very confusing. So the email address that you should write to is phoebefilms@hotmail.com, phoebephilms@hotmail.com. And you would want to tell Phoebe a little bit about how you heard of the organization and your connection to the school. And then you would be all set. So our guest this evening is Jane Espenson, who has been writing television for some of the greatest shows that there are.
Oh, I thought you were going to start listing, like, how many years? I believe it's 15 years.
15 years. Yeah. Dinosaurs, Ellen, yeah. Gilmore Girls, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, Firefly, Andy Barker, PI, and most recently you are co-executive producer on Battlestar Galactica.
Yep.
And I think I probably skipped the OC.
Yeah.
And
oh, Monty, Me and the Boys, Something's Right, a whole bunch of crap you never heard of. Nowhere Man, episode of Deep Space Nine.
Well, thank you so much for coming. Really, really appreciate it. Yeah. Yes, let's have a look. So to start with, we thought we would get a little overview of how you got to where you are now.
You know, it is a very hard business to get into. Mm-hmm. So whenever I tell this story, I want to say there's so many bits that have luck, where luck was the important card that turned over. But it did start out, I was in grad school studying linguistics at UC Berkeley. And I found out you could submit a script to Star Trek The Next Generation without an agent. You could just get a release form from Paramount and send it in, and it would get read. So I started writing them as fast as I could, sent in three of them, just like boom, boom, like one a month for, you know, as long as I could keep it up. And they called me and about the second one. And they never called me about the first one or the third one. Like, if I had stopped too soon, like, wouldn't it happen? And they said, we want you to come in and pitch. And I didn't even know what that was. I just sort of guessed. Like, well, that must mean, like, you go in and suggest episodes. And that was, thank God I was right, because I went in and suggested episodes. And they bought a premise, which, you know, like, here's $1,000. $1,000, I'm so rich. They bought a story, but that never became an episode. But it was just sort of got my foot in the door. I met other people who were doing the same thing, flying down from Cal to Paramount and pitching. And one of them told me about the Disney Writers Fellowship, which is now called the ABC Disney Writing Fellowship. And you needed a half-hour script to apply because no one was doing dramas. Dramas were dead, and there was no way they could ever come back because they didn't syndicate well. There will never be hour television again. It's all going to be half hour. So Disney wasn't even accepting hour scripts. Like, you have to submit a half hour. So I wrote a Seinfeld, and because that felt pretty good, I wrote a second Seinfeld. Nobody told me your two specs shouldn't be for the same show. But I submitted those two specs to Disney and got in. So then I was down here, and Disney put me on Dinosaurs and Monty, which were two shows they had at the time. And then I was in. Then I had an agent, and I was just getting hired, and it just never stopped. So try that.
So was the Disney Fellowship, was that the moment when you realized linguistics is not going to...
Yeah, that was when I got that in. That was when I had to take my advisor out for lunch and say, okay, you know, that dissertation that I said I was working on for the last 2 years when I was actually writing Star Trek spec scripts, that's not going to happen. So didn't finish the degree.
Okay. I'm curious, when you're writing the Star Trek spec scripts and you're in graduate school for something totally different, was there a seed of a motivation there that kept you going?
Oh, well, I'd known since I was a kid I wanted to write for TV. The idea of being a professor of linguistics sounded pretty good. The teaching sounded like fun. But the writing of the theory, internal papers, and it really... I really would much rather have written for TV. I always knew that's what I wanted to do. So as soon as I found out you could submit to Star Trek, it was just no question in my mind. It was just like, okay, drop your pen, pick up your computer, and forget about linguistics. Do this other thing. See if you can make it pan out. I was 28, and I knew that my window was closing. You know, if I was going to do this, I had to do it. So.
And was Star Trek the kind of show you were watching?
Or yeah.
That was just the...
No, thank God I was already a fan, because it really was the only open door in town. You know, I didn't know about the Fellowship yet. I think I answered a question saying that the Disney Fellowship was the moment I knew.
Yes.
That was the moment I knew I could actually do it, that I could actually move. The writing Star Trek was the moment I knew I could abandon work on the dissertation in order to make time for it. So there were two different important
right.
steps that involved turning my back in academia. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Has the motivation to write changed as you've gotten paid for it and done?
Yeah. Yeah, because when you're first doing it, at least those first few Star Trek scripts felt like you were writing fanfic. It was like, the world's open to me. I can do whatever I want. I am the puppet master. I can make Data fall in love. I can, you know, it felt very much like that. Then when you're actually hired on a show, it becomes much more about mind reading the showrunner. What does the showrunner want the show to be? What does the network want the show to be? And writing. And you lose a little bit of the joy, but you gained a different kind of joy, which is like, I can actually do this for a living. I'm actually, you know, making this happen. And then when you actually get on a show that you love and adore, like Buffy, then it becomes both. Then it's like, I am writing fanfic, and I'm proving I can do this for a living, and people are actually seeing what I'm doing, and it all comes together. And I've had that happen twice now, Buffy and Battlestar.
Excellent. Well, we're going to talk about Battlestar a little bit later, or maybe mm-hmm. we'll talk about it right now.
Wherever you
are. I was going to ask if you could give us a little bit of a tour of, like, 6 months in the life of a television writer.
Oh, wow.
Not everyone here is a writing student and so hasn't had professors explain to them how it works, and I just thought that would be a great introduction
yeah.
to it from someone who's there.
Yeah. Let's see. 6 months. The TV season is like 9 months, so let's do 9 months.
Okay, let's do 9 months.
It's like having a baby, only at the end the baby is hiatus. you start by having your meetings which you are hoping to get staffed. Mm-hmm. You go in, you've watched the pilot, if it only exists as a pilot. If it's a continuing show, you've researched, you've watched as many episodes of the show as you can get your hands on. You've read scripts if you can. You've written your specs, whatever. You go in, you got your meeting, you go in, you sit down with the showrunner, and you say, here's why I love your show, and here's where I think maybe you're going, here's what I think is cool about your show, blah, blah, blah. If you're lucky, you get hired. Now you're on the staff. Now you're meeting your colleagues and going like, okay, who's the asshole in this room? and you settle in and you start work, and you start work breaking stories. So you sit in a room. Sometimes it's a room with a conference table. Sometimes it's a room with sofas and no table. And you all sit together as a group, usually. Every show's a little different, but usually you sit as a group and you go, okay, what's going to happen in episode one? What's going to happen in episode two? And you usually talk about the season-long arcs, little arcs, you know, sort of where we want to be by episode 10, where we want to be by episode 4. Then you start going intensively episode by episode of like, okay, if episode one is this person's journey to feel this thing, and we want this event to happen in the middle. Okay, what's the first act break? What's the second act break? Okay, where's the first scene? Do we have that set? Oh, my God, can we get this actor? And you start working it out until you have on your whiteboard or your corkboard every scene of episode one, where it's set, who's in it, what's the emotional content, what event has to happen in it. When you have that all done, the episode is broken. Broken means fixed. And it's at that point usually assigned to a writer, and they get to go home for 2 weeks and write. And the rest of you sit and you do that for episode two. And it just keeps going. And after you've been doing this for maybe 6 weeks, production starts. Maybe more like 2 months. Production starts. Now they're filming that first episode. So the train is moving. But the tracks only extend that far in front of the train. So now the whole staff is putting down tracks as fast as they can because that train is coming and it's eating its script every 8 days. And you're taking 2 weeks to write them. So the track in front of the train is getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until you get to Christmas break. And then, like, the train stops. And you work ahead and you get more track down. And you just do that until the end of the year. And that's your year.
And that's your year. Yeah.
So when you're on staff, your day is one of two things. You're either at home writing. Which is completely your own timetable.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're in the office at the beck and call of the executive staff.
Right. Exactly. Now, some shows do it a little differently. Some shows, well, that was a drama. And that's how most dramas work. Some dramas never have that room. It's just you going one-on-one to your showrunner with, like, okay, here's what I think the break is for my episode. And they go, that doesn't work for me at all. And it's a lot like what Joey is doing in episode 7. So you got to change this and move that. And you go and you take it back to your office and you rework it and you bring it back to the showrunner and there's no room. Comedy is the other end of the spectrum where it's all room, where you don't get to go home for very long. When you bring in your draft, everybody rewrites it as a group. So you're all sitting around that conference table looking at a monitor where you can see the script projected up there. You know, it's the final draft page. And the whole staff shouts out punchlines at the same time. And the showrunner points at the one that won. And the writer's assistant types it in. And that's a much more intensive, crazy process. And you're also doing it at 3 in the morning. So it's a whole different thing. But again, you're right. There's two things you're doing. You're either at home on your own schedule, although it can be a very tight schedule, or you are in amongst other writers thinking really hard about story.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, some of us are graduating and going out into the world, and let's say someone here is going to hit it out of the ballpark with some amazing spec, and they're going to be hired on staff.
Mm-hmm.
Their first day as a baby writer, what are some things that they might see? Like, who in this room is an asshole, for example?
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, it's a good idea to be quiet as the new staff writer, to sort of suss out the currents in the room. Don't be jumping in with a lot of opinions, and don't put down the show, and don't get pulled into the gossip circle. You know, if a bunch of writers are all whispering about how one of the other writers isn't a very good writer, don't join in. Don't say anything about anybody that could get back to anybody. Just like normal office politics stuff apply. Just sort of, you know, be cool, be quiet, figure out how it's going. And really, really, really knock it out of the park when you get your shot. I remember when I once met a young writer, when I was a young writer, who showed me their first draft. They were on a staff, and they showed me their first draft, and I was looking through it. They were going to turn it in the next day, and I was like, oh, this joke, you know, I think you can do better. Like, you could really, this script could really sparkle. Let's punch up these three jokes, and I'll help you, and it'll be fun, it'll be good. And she said, well, they're going to rewrite it anyway. And it's like, but dude, like, this is your chance. Like, it doesn't matter that none of the jokes will be there anymore. Make sure that they're as good as you possibly can, because this is your one chance where you can say, this is my work solo, and they know it, and you can shine. So really, really work hard when you get there, and be cheerful at 3 in the morning. And, you know, it's all the normal office stuff.
Only with writing.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, what is Battlestar Galactica like?
Oh, it's so cool. Oh, man. You guys would love this. Let me tell you. It's a very, very professional room. It's the oldest room I think I've been in. It's all men, except for me. And they're all a little older than me, which is weird, because in the last couple years I've found myself going, I'd always been the kid in the room, and now I've become sort of the oldest person in the room. And now I'm the kid again, which is really fun. But a lot of them were journalists. 3 or 4 of them have written books. Like, they're really professional, thoughtful, intelligent people. We'll sit in the room and talk about military history, history of religion, you know, all sorts, the sort of great stuff, all that stuff that makes Battlestar special, that it's really done by thoughtful people who have something to say. That's all reflected in the room. And it's run a little differently. We don't have the showrunner in the room with us every day. Ron comes in maybe once every week or once every 2 weeks. We show him what we've done. We say, here's what we think episode 10 is. And we walk him through it. And he goes, I like what you've done. Or, I like some of this. Or, I like the general direction. He always likes something. And then, Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he's got this staff that sort of has learned how to present a story they know he'll like, which is hard to do. So much of your job is mind reading that there are some jobs where you never get close to, you know, the showrunner comes in or the showrunner's been there with you and you're all shouting out things and nobody gets close to what they want. And this show, the staff is so good, and so they've been with him for a long time. I'm new, but they've all been there. So they present a thing, and he goes, great, just move that there. Make sure this is deeper. Let's change this to that. And go, done. Like, there's only been one time so far this year where he said, okay, think about these things, rework it. I'll be back in a week. Every other time, he's been able to do it right in the room. So it gets to where he's, like, saying, okay, go write the outline on this now, you know, because we've just fixed it. So that's fantastic. I wrote two freelance Battlestars last year, but as a freelancer, you aren't really involved in going to see it filmed or anything. It's like I turned in my script, did a couple rewrites, but more rewriting happened after I was done, and then all the shooting and all the cutting and everything. So I sort of went from, like, here's a script to turning on the TV and there's the episode. This year I'm going to get to see all that stuff in between. So I can't really comment on that yet because I haven't been through it, but, you know, we'll get to... Each of us will get to go up to Vancouver when our episode's being shot and meet the actors and all that good stuff.
And also, you'll be writing to an outline that you helped shape.
Right. Well, I wrote the outlines for my freelances, but I did not come up with the stories. Although, I won't come up with my stories this year either. They're all room. On very few shows, you actually come in with pitches. On most shows, the story ideas sort of come out of group discussions, not so much a formal pitching session with the showrunner. It's just somebody, you know, there's already a list when you show up if you want to do stories on these themes, and a couple people have strong ideas. The showrunner usually has a whole bunch of ideas. So writing this one, the ones I will write this year, won't be that much different from the freelances until you get to the production part.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we're probably going to have a lot of questions, but I just wanted to ask one of my own.
Uh-huh.
Your website is phenomenal for the person who's trying to spec an existing episode of television.
Thank you, thank you. JaneEspenson.com, check it out.
It went out with the invitation, so okay. if they heard about this, they've seen the link. And you get like $1 every time someone comes there, right?
I get nothing. I get nothing.
My question was about writing a spec pilot,
yeah.
Which is like sort of a new thing. But you have actually written pilots as part of development deals.
Right, right.
Now, the master that you're serving there is the person who's paying you to write the pilot.
Right.
But for yourself, what are you hoping for as you're working on it? Because you're not shooting for, like, this is going to be the greatest Grey's Anatomy ever.
Right.
It's something completely new.
Right. It has to be something from your own head. And yeah, what I usually, when I know I'm going to have to go in and pitch pilots, I just start making lists of like all my favorite shows ever, my favorite movies, my favorite shows, and just themes that I'm interested in real life. So, you know, I guess I can't discuss ones I've written because I don't own them. NBC Universal
Sure.
owns them or 20th owns them. But you know, I sort of, if I write down, you know, Defending Your Life, Groundhog Day, you know, just sort of list my favorite things, Tootsie, and I'll just sort of look at them and think about stories that come to mind that sort of involve those themes, you know, lightly comedic with a hint of magic, but with a message that's something about how one lives one's life without... I like themes that are sort of about finding strength in our humanness, not in a spiritual thing that's outside ourselves but inside ourselves, you know. So I'll think about those things and try to come up with some, I mean, that sounds so esoteric, so high level, but it is like you have to start there.
No,
and then you end
sense.
Up with like the cop who's secretly an elf, and you but you know in your heart that it's really about like the strength of the human spirit.
So when you're writing the cop who's secretly an elf, you're is your goal to make the cop like as believable a person as possible, or
yeah.
amazing plot revelations, or kind of both?
No, totally character. I mean, once I've got the hook,
yeah.
he's an elf. He's an elf. Like, he's in the closet. You can do all this metaphorical stuff. then you start going, like, who is this guy? And you can do, you know, am I picturing John Goodman? You know, who's the cop here? And then you know, characters I've liked, people I like, you know, who is this person? What are their aspects of their personality? And then that'll lead you to the next thing. If you go, oh, well, wait a minute, okay, So what's going to be an interesting character to secretly be an elf? Well, it should be a big guy. It should be a guy who never knew he was an elf and suddenly finds out when he's 45 that he's an elf, that he's descended from the ancient woodland creatures. Who is going to be most affected by discovering this about themselves? Well, sort of an intolerant guy, you know, and you start thinking about, well, what would be a good city to have this set in? Some place with a good strong cop culture. Maybe it's Chicago, yeah. And it just sort of all spins off from there. And it's not that different from what you do as a viewer. Even if you guys weren't film students, if you were just TV viewers, you will watch a show and some secondary character will interest you, or you'll start saying, like, gee, you know, I wonder what would happen if this happened. Why, well, that would be a whole different, you know, like if you like The OC or something and you go, like, well, what if Misha Barton could do magic? And you start imagining that show, and then you've got a show in your head. I mean, I actually find the problem isn't so much that people get into the business without having a pilot idea in their head. No, it's the opposite. It's that there's people out there driving tractors in Nebraska who have beautiful pilots in their head, but no way to get it to anybody. That's the letter I most often get addressed to the website is, I'm, you know, an insurance adjuster in Topeka, and I've got this great idea. And you sort of go, well, I worked in television for 12 years before I got to tell anyone my idea for a pilot. There's no way to do it. I mean, you guys are really lucky that you're funneling yourself into the machine that's going to allow you to do it. But most people haven't had that chance. And the pilot business is just sort of a closed business.
The idea of a show that's a metaphor for something else reminds me of another question I had, which is with Battlestar Galactica, I think the fans, I know the media, endlessly like to talk about who is it. We're the Iraqis. No, we're the occupiers. No, it's the French Revolution. No, right. It's... And is that part of the room culture when you're talking about the show, or...
Yeah, only it's not a fixed correspondence. It's not a fixed mapping. The mapping moves around, which is what's so great about the show, because sometimes you are the Iraqis and sometimes you're the ally. You know, who you are in a given personal interaction, in a given political situation, shifts around a bit. The good guys and bad guys. That's what I love about Battlestar, is that there is no moral cheat sheet. There is no, if I know where I stand in current U.S. politics, I know which character I should believe in on that show, because things shift around. And you know, you could go, well, there's nothing in the world that could make me be sort of anti-abortion, until they do the episode where you're like, oh, wait, there's only 40,000 humans left. Oh, well, that it does kind of change things. Or, like, I would never be in favor of fixing election. And you go, but if I don't, Baltar wins. Oh! Like, stuff shifts around. And the episode where there was this idea, this realization that there was a way we could spread a disease among the Cylons and wipe out the whole Cylon race, and this war could be over and humanity could be saved. The little homunculus in your heart sits up at that act break and waves a flag and goes, yay, we're going to survive. And then you go, like, crap, it's genocide. Damn, put the flag away. Like, wait, that's bad. That's wrong. And you go, but it would save humanity. And are they really, they're, and you sort of, it's such an interesting show because it doesn't make it clear cut. It makes you think and examine and reassign the roles and go, oh, this whole time I thought those characters were the ones I didn't like, but I do like them. And that's actually what I said my first time I met with Ron. Well, remember when I got to go in and pitch at Star Trek? I pitched to Ron Moore, who was like little baby story editor at Star Trek. Then 15 years later, I'm going like, Ron Moore has created the best show on television. And I begged for a meeting at Battlestar and ran in and just all breathless because I was late. I ran in and was like, Ron, do you remember me? And he did. And I was like, I want to write for your show. And he said, why? And I said, because there's no moral cheat sheet. And he sat up and said, yes! I was like, okay, that's a good sign in the meeting when they sit up and say yes. But so I know this isn't just me. This is like Ron, too. It's like it's a show where the morality shifts around. And so, yeah, there you can decode it and apply American politics. You just can't do it consistently. For every episode, you have to refigure out who the roles are.
Which is different from Buffy, where it was pretty much all the time growing up is like fighting monsters.
Well, yeah, high school is hell was the metaphor, but I think the good guys and bad guys moved around on Buffy too. The metaphor stayed the same, but But Joss and Ron, both of them have the same favorite thing, which is an argument where you agree with whoever's speaking. And then the next other person speaks, and you go, oh, no, wait, they're the right. No, they're the right one. You know, when in the finale of Battlestar this year, when Lee exposed the fact that Laura's cancer had come back, weren't you kind of going like, Lee, you've got this thing in your pocket. You can use it. It's the right thing to do, because these charges really don't support what they're trying to convict Baltar of. But then when she was speaking, you were like, don't do it, Lee, don't do it. She's a good woman, and she's trying to do a good thing. And sure, the charge, we don't have the evidence to support the charges, but we know Baltar's guilty. And you just, ooh, you shift around. And Joss would do the same thing. You'd have, you know, Spike, poor starving Spike tied to the chair during Thanksgiving, going like, can't I have some of the turkey blood? And you're like, well, he's got a point. Turkey's already dead. So yeah, I think they both had sort of a similar point of view about letting the morality be a little fluid.
Interesting. Well, do we have questions that people want to ask? Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to repeat the question for the podcast. Oh, yeah. The question is about changing genres from comedy to drama and how you went about it.
When I did the big jump from sitcoms, because you remember I got in with these Star Trek specs and stuff, but then when the first time I got hired for real money on a staff was sitcom, and I did sitcoms for 5 seasons. I'd become semi-established because I'd done well on Ellen. Like, I didn't feel like I performed really well on the shows up till then, but Ellen I felt like I'd done well, like, okay. And I wanted to switch because I loved the way Ellen was run so much, I didn't want to go back to a 3 a.m. show where it was all sort of shouting in unison and stuff. So I told my agent I want to switch to drama. And he was like, no, stop, freeze. Like, you'll be treated like a newcomer. All those credits, all that reputation, it will be gone. You'll be starting from ground zero. You'll have to start as, like, staff writer again. I even had some executives tell me, executives at 20th, I think, told me, and they'd be long gone by now. This was 10 years ago, saying, they said, we'd be really reluctant to give you an overall deal ultimately because you're not demonstrating any focus. You're flibbertigibberty in the wind. Like, which are you, comedy or drama? But I knew that I wasn't really making it in comedy, that I really felt like drama, I'd be much more likely to have a successful career with some longevity in drama. And I just felt that Buffy was the place for me. So I sort of insisted. I wrote an NYPD Blue spec and told my agent, get this out there specifically to Buffy. Got the meeting, got the job, switched back. And then once I'd done that switch, I was mobile. Like, everybody thought that I'd be locked into drama, but I actually wasn't. And since then, I've done procedural and, you know, as well as comedic hour. I've gone back to half hour, single camera half hour, and I've done animated. So I've learned, like, everything there is. And it's sort of like the more mobile you are, the more you exercise that flexibility, the more you can move back and forth. And also, things have changed since I did it. With the death of comedy, more and more comedy writers have fled to drama, which has helped that membrane become even more permeable. So now it's a lot easier to go back and forth than it used to be, although you're probably still going to find agents who will tell you to focus. So, you know, I'd suggest try writing a half-hour spec. You know, write it. Everybody should have an office spec. Hope you all have one. And just to see if you can do it. Does it feel good? Does that feel right? But you should also have, you know, Grey's Anatomy or something. See how that goes. And you'll probably know which one you are. Some people are absolutely terrified at the idea of sitting down to write a joke. And other people, it's like, oh, thank God, a joke. I don't have to think about story for a second. You know? So, you know, you probably know which one you are, but there is more flexibility than there used to be. You can move around a bit more.
Cool. Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
I'm not going to fangirl too much. We need Battlestar Galactica, I promise. Yeah. Dirty Hands is a perfect example of the politics that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Am I on the side of the poor struggling laborers? Or, my God, these laborers can hold us over a barrel and yeah, okay. Go on.
I love that you sort of described the idea of writing experiences to be something between fan fiction and something that's credited.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what you thought about Battlestar Galactica's podcast, especially in terms of fandom. Because I know they're doing a lot of writers' room podcasts, they're doing, you know, episodes of podcasts that Ron War is doing that are revealing a lot of the sort of narrative possible trajectories the story could have taken.
Okay,
it's a question about the Battlestar Galactica Writer's Room podcast.
Yeah.
I'm curious to think how you feel maybe that interacts with fan authors and how they're sort of either hindered or helped by those sort of potential narratives.
Oh, okay, I see what you're asking. Because I thought at first you might be asking about the webisodes, but you're asking specifically about when a showrunner, and it wouldn't even have to be just a podcast, but like when a showrunner goes online and says, we thought about doing this, but we didn't, we did that. Mm-hmm. You're talking about how that influences the fan experience or you as potential, right? I personally always loved that when I was trying to write for Trek, when I was going down and pitching every 6 months at Star Trek, I started going to the Star Trek conventions because they would actually have little writer seminars where the writer for the show would come out and they would say things like that. Ron Moore was one of them who did it, who's now doing the podcast for Galactica. So he's always sort of had this tradition that he's open to saying, we almost did this, but we did that. I always loved that because I felt like it was a peek in the writer's room and a peek at all these other alternate universe versions of the show that could let my imagination go. So I liked it. I've noticed that other people sometimes don't like it because it does break the illusion, or you feel like, oh, wait, so if that could have happened or that, then the thing that I saw doesn't feel as much like canon anymore. It just feels like one of a number of possible things that happens to be the one they produced. But since you guys aren't just fans, you're aspiring writers, I would say be open to all of that. Find out everything you can about all the directions the show almost went, because those are all the things that can help you figure out what your spec should be about and will help you when you're in a writer's room trying to come up with, I mean, you can't get married to one idea in the writer's room because it'll be thrown out an hour from now, and it would be great if you could be the first one to say, well, what if we did this instead? So you should always be thinking of all the other alternate paths and not get locked in. I think the podcasts can help you open up your imagination like that. Does that help? Or do you?
No, okay. I'm actually writing a dissertation. I'm not a writer. So.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're writing a dissertation, you're writing.
Writers, right in there, writing a dissertation. Yeah. Do you have a question?
I have a two-part question. Uh-huh. One part you may want to pass on answering, which would be totally
fine. Ooh, it's about spoilers.
And a compliment. What's that? It's about what?
Spoilers? You want to know what's going to happen?
No.
Oh, okay.
First compliment. I just watched Superstar again before coming, and I bet Jonathan episode is brilliant. So
thank you.
I just want to say how much, from the get-go, that was one of my favorite things of all TV time. Second, I think it's interesting with your background in linguistics that you ended up on two shows that use language so inventively with Buffy and with Firefly. I'm wondering how much that played into your enjoyment of the writing. Especially the play, I know there's only one Firefly episode that we ever saw, but the invented language, but also the sort of playfulness with Buffy. And the second part would be what, in your opinion, happened with Firefly, given how well things went down for Buffy and how well Angel was going, just wondering what you're doing. And I'm also writing a paper about that.
Okay, cool. Oh, I love that people are asking academically angled questions. So there was some praise, and there was a question about language.
A question about the playfulness of language on Buffy, and a question about what happened with Firefly.
Okay.
Language and Firefly, too.
Yeah. And Firefly. Yeah, the language, Firefly in particular, was really, really fun to write because of the sort of pseudo-Western dialect that we got to write. I loved that. There was just nothing I liked better than sitting down to write a Firefly scene because it had that I'm here to meet a man, set to hire a man. that where you're like, what is the syntax of that? It's all these reduced clauses and, oh. It was great, and words like palaver, and just words you don't hear anymore. And shindig, I mean, just getting to use shindig, I loved that, and it was almost a courtly kind of speech. I reckon I know this dance, and that was so much fun. And Buffy had the sitch stuff, all that sort of Joss speak, which was all just us imitating Joss's natural speech. So that wasn't so much invented. That was just, we just all imitated Joss. And Battlestar's got its own thing going on because of we actually were all given a little handbook of an Air Force, a handbook that's given to Air Force pilots of like, this is all the way you will call in when you're out on a mission. You will say this, so we have all that skids up stuff, whatever it is, that we use for the pilots. So that has its own kind of language too. And Ty has his own way of speaking. It's almost like every show. Gee, when I was on Ellen, Helen's trademark is these long rambles where she gets caught in little language cul-de-sacs and has to pull herself out. very specific way of speaking that often had very specific word choices. Every show has that. I wrote a line for Ellen's mom where I wanted her to comment on the fact that something was funny to her, and I had her use the word comical instead of funny, which is the way my grandmother would say funny. It's just sort of a little bit of a vintage, a word that a woman in her 50s would use instead of the one the woman in her 20s would. It's like every show gives you that opportunity to play with linguistics a little bit. But Firefly was really special in that respect. As to what happened with Firefly, it got put through the process that all shows get put through. They're, you know, they're manipulated and massaged and put out in sort of a funny order, and they're not given very long to hit or miss. So, I mean, it's Andy Barker. That wasn't the order we wrote those episodes in. I think they did a fine job of promoting Andy Barker. It didn't happen to click with America quickly enough. I think it would have, but, you know, that's how shows are presented. It's just how the machine works. Yeah. Well, it's lightning in the bottle meets luck of the draw. I mean, sometimes you'll have a show like Friends that was like a hit from the first episode, and you just go, oh, the right timing, the right subject, the right promotion, the right network, right cast, it all came together, boom. And so if any one of those things goes wrong, and given the current, you know, things have to hit right away, you know, well, it doesn't happen. But, you know, enough, the fact that good shows are surviving, the fact that Battlestar is around, you know, the fact that Tina Fey is around, the fact that they kept The Office on despite low numbers, you know, till it found people, that's all good. There's a lot of good stuff on TV right now. So it's hard to bemoan the loss of some very, very good shows when you look at how good the landscape as a whole is right now. Because you go like, oh, there's a lot of good shows that are surviving.
I heard you say Battlestar Galactica is the best show on television, which I pretty much agree with. you know, because you're here. No, I really do like the show. But like,
next week is House going to be the best show on television?
No, Lori, awesome. but I was going to ask you, so when you function at that high level as a writer, what can you watch that sort of satisfies you that you don't just constantly go, God, that's the worst third act break I've ever seen?
Oh, I'm sort of able to turn off the TV writer when I watch TV, and I'm just a viewer again. I'm just a 13-year-old going like, you Lori. And I fall for things all the time. I don't see twists coming. You know? Like, if I put on my analytical hat, I do. But if I'm just sitting there as a viewer, like when I read the television without pity recaps of America's Next Top Model, where they're going like, well, it was obvious from the editing that What's-Her-Name was going to be out this week. I'm always reading the recap going like, I didn't know at that point. I guess you're right. I guess it wasn't. But I wasn't thinking about it. I was just going like, oh, everybody's saying that What's-Her-Name is going to be out. So I guess she's going to be out. Like, I fall for stuff. So, yeah, it doesn't. Watching TV does not become a painful analytical experience. It's still fun.
That's awesome. I'm so relieved. So you watch House, and you watch America's Next Top Model.
I do. Friday Night Lights is brilliant. Friday Night Lights is right up there in the battle for best show on TV. It's really, really good. Check it out, because they need the numbers. Tina Fey, The Office. But you know what? What I never got into Sopranos, even though, you know, it was great. I just sort of was like, it's going to be a marriage. Do I have the energy to devote to a marriage? You know, I'll pick it up later. And there, you know, oh, but I did find Rome. Love Rome. You know, there's really great stuff. The Wire, I feel like I started watching it. It was so brilliant, but it was also so mysterious to me because they don't help you at all with, like, who are these people? So I realized I'm going to have to go back and start from the beginning. So I've just been putting that off because it's an effort. But I know I'm going to love it. So, yeah, great stuff.
Excellent.
And a lot of Drek that I like, you know. I watch bad stuff, but love it.
Sure. Margaret, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not writing a paper, though. My question does have something to do with language use.
Uh-huh.
I was recently had a meeting with a guy from my office who, like, he knew I was a writer, so like, yeah, let me read your script. And we go out, and we're talking, and he's got a background in development, and used to work in an agency and all that stuff. And mm-hmm. So he asked me about, you know, it's like I'm writing a pilot, what's the pilot about? And I start to go into my little spiel, and I get about two sentences into it, and he stops, and he's like, no, stop that right now. And I'm like, what? And he goes, you're talking like a writer. I'm like, well, I am a writer is like, you can't talk like that to these people. And so I was wondering, I mean, do you actually have, like, the two versions of what you talk about? You know, the way you talk to people in suits and the way you talk to the guy in jeans and a baseball cap.
Yeah, the questions about sort of pitching to execs versus explaining to another writer what your project is.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, how stealthy do you actually have to be?
It's funny. Maybe I do it automatically, you know, but there is a thing where execs want to hear it in a couple sentences, and they want to hear, they don't want to hear about the character's childhood. They don't even want to hear really about the character as much as you might think. Where, you know, you may spend a couple pages full of working out who this character is, and they'll ask a few questions about the character, but they're going to want to know more about story. And so, yeah, you do kind of tackle it a little differently.
So, like, beyond the hook, there's less interest in, it's like, this is what it means, and this is why people will love it. It's like, no.
Yeah, I mean, you want to do... I always feel like why people will love it is sort of their business. Like, they're in charge of knowing what people will love. I'm just going to tell you a story I think is interesting. So I try not to get into their business too much and tell them all that stuff. But, you know, I think this will appeal to women in the Midwest. Like, well, they know who it'll appeal to. So I tell my story. I tell my characters. You do it quickly. You do it succinctly. You compare it to things they're familiar with. And, you know, it's about that. Whereas if you go out with a friend who's a writer, you do it a little differently. You go into the character more. And you express your concerns more. Because you're going, like, help me fix this. Or does this really work? Whereas the other meeting is a sales meeting. So it's a little more, it's going to work. the language, you do use the language a little bit differently. But not, when you have really good executives, it becomes a lot more like sitting down with writers. I've really been enjoying my interaction with the executives at NBC Universal because I felt like they really are asking deep questions about character. Mm-hmm. And they really are looking down the road. They aren't just going like, will this pilot episode be interesting? They're actually asking, is this a series? Like, they're really thinking hard and asking good questions. So it depends.
Interesting. Yeah. Joanna, I think you had a question?
Yeah, I had a question. Thanks for coming so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to know, I assume kind of every TV writer's goal is to eventually have their own show, so I wanted to know if that was a goal of yours, how that works, if you just have to kind of earn enough credit to get to where people are going to listen to you, or they have to come to you and say, any ideas, you know, and kind of what you would be thinking about, would it be female-driven or not?
Oh, interesting. The question is about the getting to the stage in your career where you can do pilots, and is that every writer's goal? It's most writers' goal to create their own show. It's never been my top priority. My top priority has always been work on a good show, whether I created it or not. But I've gotten to the stage now where people are very interested in hearing what I would do for my own show. And I could have pushed it and probably gotten in and pitched pilots earlier in my career. I sort of laid back because I was enjoying where I was, enjoying the shows I was working on. So I was in no particular hurry. But a lot of people are, and they make it their goal is to create a show. Every showrunner I've met has some sort of stress and anxiety problems. it's a very, very stressful job, and generally leads to ulcers and other gastrointestinal problems. So it just never looked at, like, I better have an idea that really sets my soul on fire before I'm running a show. So it wasn't my top priority. Because now I am in development, so I am now going in and writing these things every season, like, you know, film this one. And they vary. Sometimes I do a female-driven one, and sometimes it's if it's like a young protagonist and there's this magical element, if it's a female protagonist, it feels a little too Buffy. And I go like, well, that's, I can't go there. It looks too much like I'm ripping off Joss. So I'll go, okay, what's the young man's version of this story? I sort of want to write interesting characters, and I think the male-female dynamic was a lot more crucial when there were very few strong female representatives on television. Now that we've had Buffy, we had Veronica Mars, and we've got Starbuck, it feels a little less like the next beat of my heart must be about getting a strong woman on TV. It's starting to feel like, we've got characters who are just characters now, and they're male or female or whatever they happen to be, but that's not the most important thing about them. It feels like we can do a little more of that now not entirely. We're not really out of the woods. We could so easily slip back to every female character being paper thin. But right now we're doing okay. So I'm feeling free to, like, try. Well, maybe this is, you know, the cop who's an elf, I think, is more interesting with a male character. Because he's the one who's going to have more issues with, like,
there's all kinds
elf.
Of masculinity questions
exactly.
with being
yeah.
an elf. I should introduce Donna also as the woman who brought the clamminade.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I made a reference in my website to clamminade.
I read your blog all the time. It is super, super helpful. And for people who haven't read it, ask you all the time, what should I spec, what should I spec? And now that you've talked tonight about how you got, basically you wrote your passion, you wrote mm-hmm. those you love, but sometimes we don't have agents, we don't have managers, we
right.
have advice, and the advice is always, write this, write that, or don't write this. Do you believe in the don't write this advice? Is there anything
yeah.
you really can't write?
Well, that's an interesting question.
If you're passionate.
Right. I think passion helps a lot. But, like, I didn't always write what I loved. I mean, I had a spec coach, and I didn't love coach. I mean, I had a spec Larry Sanders, too, and I adored Larry Sanders, so that was cool. This is how old I am. Larry Sanders was a man. But you have sometimes you have to write a show that doesn't capture your heart. You get staffed on a show that doesn't capture your heart. You just have to find something that you think will be the best example you can of that show. Before I wrote the Star Treks, when I was an undergraduate, I had a little burst of creative energy where I was like, I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm going to write spec scripts. I'm going to write TV. And I wrote A Perfect Strangers. Perfect Strangers, for those of you who remember, was B-grade sitcom. It was never considered a classy show. I wrote it. I loved it. I called an agent in L.A. I got an agent on the phone, and he was like, I will read a script of yours, but I am not reading a damn Perfect Stranger. Write a Golden Girls. And it says, because Golden Girls at the time was the classy show that everyone was specking. And I just didn't love Golden Girls. I tried. I couldn't come up with anything I loved, and I let that opportunity go by and then did the Star Trek thing later. So I think, but, you know, if I had been perhaps a little more dedicated to leaving college or I would have done it, and it would have been a smart thing to do, because I think there is spec the shows that showrunners want to read, that agents want to read. We are just selling the time between the commercials. That's all our job is. So you can't get too fancy about it. At a certain point, you've got to go, okay, I'm going to write this, love it or not, and make it the best I can. And writing an Andy Barker right now wouldn't be the right thing to spec, you know, as great a show as it is. You know, you got to be a little market savvy. But I got to say that every time I ask my agent what are the hot shows to spec, he gives me this story about write a play, write a short film. They should be writing things that aren't even TV specs. So it's hard to even say anymore. You know, I still say everybody should have a The Office spec. So that's the only thing I know for sure.
Yes. Like, just reading your blog, which I love, I'm always wondering, wow, I wonder what your day's like, because it seems like you're here, and you're there, and you're on this show, and then you're on that show, so what's, like, a typical day?
Because now I'm on a show, so it doesn't have so much variety. I woke up at 8, I lay in bed till 9. I think it was the Gonzalez thing was on NPR. So I was like lying there till like 9:20, and I was like, if I don't get up now, well, wait a minute, if I don't wash my hair, I can stay another. Okay. So at 10 o'clock, I was driving to work, going like, crap, I'm late. We had to be at work at 10:30 today. So I scrambled into my office, clutching my bagel at 10:30. We went in the writer's room around, you know, 11:30, because everybody was late and people had emails to check and stuff. We worked and we broke story, and there were only a few of us because most people are out writing their outlines right now. So it was all sort of like, okay, what we had to do today was we made a bunch of changes to episode 10 yesterday that required a starting place that didn't match up with the end of episode 8, which was the last time we were playing with these particular story threads. So today was about going into episode 8 and changing episode 8 so that it would end in the right place so that it would match with the start of 10. So today was all about taking the guts, taking the three story threads in episode 8. One of them had the wrong guts in it. So we had to pull all the yellow cards off the board because that was that particular story. Come up with a new story that would have the same number of beats, involve the same characters, and end up at this particular ending place. Oh, and take place over the right number of days. And find the story, figure out what the beats are, write them on the cards, and pin them up. And then the day was over. And there was lunch in there, too. Oh, most shows you do. Most shows at around noon or hopefully earlier, but sometimes it's shamefully close to noon. A PA comes in with a stack of Xeroxed menus. You circle what you want, you hand it back, and then, you know, at 2 when you're dying of hunger, they bring you your lunch and you eat your lunch. But on this particular show, because our building is right next to the cafeteria, we just all stand up at 1 o'clock and parade out like a row of ducklings and go to the cafeteria and eat and come back. So this show we don't get. That's why my lunches have been so boring lately. Right. It's all been like salad bars and cheeseburgers because it's the Universal Cafeteria. Yeah. So. Oh, I'm so sorry for the rest of you who just had to sit through what I had for lunch. I apologize.
Other questions? Well, my question actually is about the other writing that you do. Mm-hmm. You've done a couple comic books for Buffy and Tales of the Slayer.
Yeah.
And a short story that's a sequel of one of the characters in Pride and Prejudice.
Right, yeah.
And I just wondered, how did you make the decision to try something that wasn't screenwriting, and what did you get out of that?
Well, the comic book thing was sort of an open invitation to all the Buffy writers. Anyone want to do comic books? And then the Tales of the Slayer thing came along, and Joss really was like, we should all take a chapter of this. Like, I want you guys to all do this. So we all, and I said, I want the one that's like Jane Austen. I want to do a Jane Austen, like, he said, name an era. He actually went in, we put it on the whiteboard, and it was like, everyone gets to pick an era. You know, so Rebecca Kirshner said, I want Nazi Germany, and Doug Petrie was like, I want 1970s New York City, and I said, I want Regency England. And we looked, and Fury wanted the Old West, and we looked, and we had this, like, totally nicely distributed, you know, parts of the world and time eras. And he was like, great, go write those. So that's how I got to do comic books, was it was just sort of like, here, you throwing you into the water, you know, okay. But the short stories were also, I mean, we've all written short stories, like, since we were kids, probably. And you do it for assignments and stuff, so I felt like that's something I could do. Again, it was a Buffy thing. They were doing a collection of Buffy short stories, and they asked if I wanted to do one of those. So I did that, and then the same company was doing this Jane Austen collection, and they asked, would I like to write one of those? So it's just sort of things led to things led to things. But I think if you write one thing, you probably write the others. I don't know a lot of screenwriters who don't also have some short stories at home. So you tend to, if you write, you write.
Is it a kind of a relief in fiction that you can put a character's inner life right on the page?
Yes, because you totally forget that's even an option when all you've been doing is writing teleplays for years and years and years. I mean, there was probably a 20-year gap between writing the last short story I wrote for college, some class, and writing that Buffy short story. It was a vampire short story. I don't think Buffy was in it. Big old gap in which I had been only writing teleplays, and I'd sort of forgotten about people's inner that you could say he said embarrassed instead of Jason embarrassed, you know. And it was totally freeing. You can do totally different kinds of things, and so now I'm sort of trying to keep limber in that respect. I'm not going to let it go so long before I write more short stories, because I think it's good for you to remind yourself that there are these other genres. And Joss is big on, when he gets inspired, he makes the genre fit the idea. He doesn't just go, I'm going to think of a movie. He thinks of a story, and then he goes, okay, is this a movie, a TV show, or a ballet? You know, and then he, whatever it is, he makes what that is. I actually remember at one point he was writing a ballet, because the story he had was a ballet. And so he's totally... Not every idea can be shoehorned into every genre. And so I like that idea of keeping yourself limber and making the genre fit what your idea is.
And do you have a favorite thing that you've written, like a thing that you're just like, okay, that was pretty good?
That superstar episode of Buffy that you like, I like that one very much. there are a couple episodes of Buffy, and I think Dirty Hands, the Galactico, the second Galactica I wrote, turned out really well. Yeah, those are probably the ones I'm most proud of. I'm proud of individual jokes I wrote on Ellen, because that was, I'd sort of felt like I wasn't doing very well in comedy rooms to that point, and then in that room, I started, like, every script had a bunch of jokes I wrote, and I felt like they were good, solid, like I'd learned it, like I'd cracked the code. So I felt good about those.
And also the flask of emergency bisque line from
Barker. Andy Barker, yeah. I was happy with that one.
I'd write that on a pillow if I remember. Well, are there things that you wrote that now, if you could do it differently, you would?
God, yes. I look back at that first, the first televised episode I wrote was the episode of Dinosaurs called Variations on a Theme Park, where they all go to, like, a coded version of Disneyland. And I look at it now, and I'm like, it's not very good. And I actually think Band Candy, my first Buffy that for years I adored, I look at it now and I kind of go, like, I could have done better. I don't think it's as sharp in some places as it should be.
I'm dumbfounded.
There are definitely things where I look at it and I go, like, that's not...
Thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's good. No, you came prepared.
Saying that you crack the code as far as joke writing, and
right.
I guess, and you speak about this on your blog all the time, and I'm just wondering if you could speak about it here, of just when you don't feel you're necessarily naturally funny.
Right.
And what structure to jokes, yes, what is it, you know?
I think it's interesting that when, like, if you describe someone as having a good sense of humor, usually you don't mean that they crack jokes, you mean that they laugh at jokes, right? I mean, if you say, oh, you'll love him, he has a good sense of humor, you kind of mean, like, when he goes to a funny movie, he laughs in the right places. So it seems like it should follow that if you know what's funny when you hear it, you should be able to crack the code and write it. And I kind of think that's true. It doesn't mean you'll necessarily be great in the room pitching, and I never was good in the room pitching jokes, but I could sit down and write one. And I think it was because I'm an analytical person, and I was able to sort of take it apart. And I heard an interview once with Rita Rudner, where she talked about when she decided to become a stand-up comic, she sat down and approached it like it was math. She looked at jokes that worked and jokes that made audiences laugh and go, okay, what's the structure that's doing it? So that's why I'm not afraid to analyze jokes the way a lot of naturally funny people are, because they have this fear of, like, I don't know how it works, I just know I can do it. I can open my mouth and say something funny. If I start thinking about how the pieces fit together, I might lose that. But I know I never had that. What I've got is I better rely on the analytical stuff. So I'm not afraid to start taking them apart and go, like, oh, this plugs into that. I get it. You know. So those of you who are afraid of jokes because you don't feel like you are the funniest person when you go out for pizza, don't fear. You can still write a funny script that will get you a lot of attention and will get you on, say, a humorous hour where you don't have to worry about pitching jokes in the room. Or a half hour where, like Ellen, you can sort of use something in the structure of the room so that you don't have to be shouting out the jokes. So, yeah. Good, yeah.
Yes. Simple question. You mentioned with Galactica being the only woman in the room. I'm wondering how often that happens or has happened to you in your career. Like, I'm a little shocked, actually. You know what I mean? Is that you'd be... I mean, it makes sense, I guess, the military, but I'm just wondering...
Okay, the question is about being the only woman in the room. It happens more in comedies than dramas. This is the first drama I've been on where I've been the only woman. Mm-hmm. And in fact, looking back at comedies, I think there was always... No, I think I was sometimes the only woman. There would have been another woman in the room because the writer's assistant was a woman. But I think there were times I was the only woman writer. Dinosaurs, I was the only woman writer there. I used to be really conscious of it, and now I'm not anymore. And I think it's just a matter of feeling confident. And it's also realizing that times have changed a little bit while I've been doing this, and there's no longer extra high hurdles for you to prove yourself as a woman. You're just one of the other writers, so you don't feel that awful, like, oh, I have to be twice as good. You know, that whole thing has gone away a bit. You can just go in and be a writer. But it is, the fact is, whether it's surprising that Battlestar has men or women, to me, it feels now like it's not because it's military. It's simply because if you flip a coin randomly, sometimes you get 8 heads in a row. It's more like that now. It's more like sometimes you hire the best 8 writers that come across you and are available. You know, it is a certain amount of flipping of a coin. And to a certain extent, you go like, I heard that one, that one, that one, that one. Oh, look, they're all boys. Well, if I want to believe that I can write Xander or Giles or Tyrell as well as a male writer, then I should be able to say I think they could write the females as well as I can. So you just sort of, I think you're saner and happier if you just sort of go like, well, we're all good writers, so I'm not gonna fret about it, because then I'm gonna be setting up extra hurdles in my own mind. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, sometimes it's not the most comfortable thing when things get dirty and you're like, gee, I wish there were another woman in the room so I could roll my eyes at her.
You could bring a puppet.
Yeah.
Maybe then not on a gender level, but just on your own personal level, do you find that there's something you bring to the room at Battlestar Galactica that's not there when you're not there?
There does seem to be a certain type of comment that I make, I think, but it's not exclusive to me, and it's about theme. It's always sort of going, oh, look, if we do this, then this story, then the A story echoes the C story. They're both about how a moral decision does blah, you know, whatever the theme is.
How that person is totally secretly a Cylon.
Yeah. it's sometimes people totally secretly are Cylons. It's great. But yeah, usually I'm the one who's pointing out, oh, look, we can make a themic connection there if we do this. Or here's a nice little grace note for this scene, a little emotional moment. And it's kind of weird that, again, it feels a little flip of the coiny that, yeah, it's the female writer who's the one going like, look at the emotional resonance of this moment. And yet I don't feel that. I think that's just me being me. Mm-hmm. And a male writer would be just as likely to be the one pointing out the emotional thing. Because these certainly are not unemotional writers. If you look at the history of writing on Battlestar, it's not dry. It's, in fact, quite tear-soaked. You know? So these guys can clearly do it.
You made actually a distinction about different kinds of shows on your blog, like Star Trek versus a show like Battlestar Galactica. Was the distinction you made shows about ideas versus shows about feelings?
Shows about ideas versus like shows about character. And I think the reason that a lot of people think they don't like sci-fi is because they're remembering like the heavy-handed Star Trek episodes with the black and white face. Oh, God. And it's like there's no characters in the show. There's just an idea. It's just like, racism is bad. That's an idea. Doesn't necessarily suggest 2 characters having a really interesting revelation about each other. It could, but it doesn't necessarily. And I think Battlestar is the kind of sci-fi that is about people, and that Firefly was too. And I think that's much more interesting. And that's why I think people who think they don't like sci-fi need to be dragged in front of their television sets far more often and forced to watch shows like Battlestar, because it's not what they think it is. They think it's going to be those big message episodes. You know, the Twilight Zone that's about like, oh, look, beauty's subjective because we thought she was ugly. But it's like those were great, but they were just nifty little ideas, not people.
Yeah. I'm sure I saw a hand in the back.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, it was really, really interesting because I was coming right off Buffy, and it was like, where am I going to go? Buffy's been my home for 5 years. And I went to Gilmore Girls, and it was really fun. It was, Amy was really, really sweet to me, and what I learned was so much about story and so much about how stretchy television is as a medium, because that show breaks every rule. It breaks every rule of good drama, and yet it works. And I'm still trying to figure out why it works. But it taught me so much about don't be afraid to break the rules. They had like 12-page scenes that were about an event that happened off-screen between episodes to a minor character, and with line after line after line that neither advanced story nor exposed character. And the whole thing was on the phone. So your characters weren't even in the same room. And it was like, this shouldn't work. And act breaks, there was no sense. The act break would be like wherever the story was on that page. And the scripts were like 20 pages too long, and so everyone had talked really fast. And yet it was a great show. Gilmore Girls was a good show. It was involving. It was emotional. You cared. It felt. And I decided that part of what made that show work was the fact that it did break the rules, which meant that you couldn't put on your analytical hat even if you wanted to. There is no way to watch Gilmore Girls and go, oh, I see where they're going. Because there's no way to where we're going. Like, they're not supposed to be on page 12 of a scene anyway. That doesn't happen. So I think it had the most intense verisimilitude of any show I've ever worked on, where conversations would just flow the way they flow in real life, and that never happens on TV. It was totally fascinating, and I learned a lot. But you don't get to do a lot of fingers on your keys. We did a lot of sitting in the room breaking stories, but it tended to be Amy who had her fingers on the keys, and that's my favorite part of the process, is when you're sent out and you get to do the writing. So ultimately I felt like it wasn't the perfect fit for me because of where I feel that my best skills are. But it sure was a fun year. And I love Amy, and it was all groovy.
Yeah. So some questions over here. You had a question.
Yeah. If you could tell us a little bit about writing partners and the marketability of that. Mm-hmm. And if you at some point have to kill your writing partner in the middle of the night, do you have to start all over?
Yes, you do. The question is about killing your writing partner. yeah, that's the downside of having a writing partner. If you have to kill them, you have to start all over. You're never going to be able to use those specs again. Everyone is never going to know how much of it is you, and they're going to assume that all the good parts are your partner, because that's the safe thing for them to assume. So that is the danger. The good thing is that you have someone there to do reality checks with. If you have some meeting with a crazy person or you have a year with a showrunner who's really abusive and you're like, maybe I'm just bad, you know, you've got someone there to go, no, you're not. You're not bad. We're good. you have someone to share the work with. You also share the paycheck. You get paid. You split a paycheck as a writing team. So there's ups and downs. I've never done it. I think I probably would be better in the room, though, if I had the experience of writing with a partner, because when I'm in my home, I never have to discuss story with someone. I work it out in my own head. So it makes my experience writing a script very different from my experience in a room. Partners have a much more uniform writing year. They're talking story at home with their partner. They're talking story at work. And they don't ever get out of practice with the putting it out on the table and working it through and rehashing and rebreaking. So I think it can be very good for you. Did you recently kill a writing partner?
I think about it. My vein starts throbbing.
Well, do it earlier. Do it sooner rather than later.
Do it before this podcast goes up, because this is probably kind of incriminating. Yes.
You had talked about staffing, and it's in staffing season now. So it's
yes, it is.
I know that a lot of showrunners are loath to read baby writers with no credits. Is there a way to overcome that hurdle without inventing credits?
Yeah, you shouldn't invent. Well, it should help. Do you? Is it specifically about you? Do you have an agent? So you have people.
I do.
Good for you. That's really hard.
Yeah. I work for them. So.
Oh, excellent. That's.
I do have. They're sending my stuff out.
Well, so they have to be honest. They will say she doesn't have credits. But I would suggest that have a variety of different specs and have these other writing samples that people are asking for now. A comedy packet, you know, a little packet of short comedy bits. You know, fake catalog, a fake website, a comedy rant as if Stephen Colbert were doing it. You know, all of those little short comedy pieces that people want to look at now for comedy writers. The short dramatic bits that people want to look at for drama writers. That will help a showrunner be able to read your stuff without a huge time investment. Because if you're looking at a baby writer, the chances that they're going to be good with no credits feels small to the showrunner. Whether it is small or not, it feels like they're taking a crapshoot. Do they want to invest a half hour in the crapshoot or 10 minutes? You know, up your chances by having the short pieces.
What do you mean by short dramatic pieces?
Like a short film or a one-act play or a short story. My agent tells me people are hired off short stories now all the time. I am flabbergasted because if I were hiring people, I wouldn't trust that, like we were talking about, how do we know that they can write a script where they have that hand tied behind their back if they can't do what the person's thinking? So I'd want to see a show, see if they could capture the voices and script writing format. But I'd say that's the best thing to do right now is short pieces. That's the best way to make people read something with no credits.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just take a few more questions. Yes, Maria.
Agent is better. If you have both, you're giving away a big chunk of money. Of course, you're not giving away money till you have money, so that's okay. But I have heard of people who've had success with managers. You know what? I actually don't know that I'm qualified to answer that because I don't know well enough what is helping people get their first jobs right now. Let me ask my agent. I'll post it on my blog.
I bet your agent loves managers.
Oh, right. Crap. I don't know. I don't know. It's going to have to be my answer.
He might really love
it. He might.
I never know. Well, I had one last question.
Yeah.
We can take one or two more after this. So think about what you want to ask.
We can also do that thing where people crowd up
and
ask after.
Yeah, we can wrap it up and mingle. Yeah. We'll have canapé. No. When a new baby person, maybe not even a staff writer, is walking into an office to take some kind of preliminary meeting.
Right.
People in that room, in that building, know that the show is a show that is there until 3 o'clock in the morning, and people secretly lock themselves in their closets and cry. But they won't say those things. They won't grab you and say, run as fast as you can. Or maybe they do. But are there signs? Are there things we can look for so that we don't spend 2 years...
Well, you know what? For one thing, there's nothing wrong with spending 2 years on a bad show if it's your entree to Hollywood. I'd say take any job, good or bad. You're going to learn something, and having your bad experiences early on teaches you a lot about your own survival skills and your confidence in your writing and the fact that you can do it. If you've never been on the 3 a.m. show and you have it when you're 40, you're going to freak out. If you knew you could do it when you were 25, you know, it's better. So I'd say there's nothing, at this point, a baby writer should not be worried about is the job experience going to be good or not. Just get a job. They're so rare. But sometimes showrunners will tell you. I had a showrunner meeting last year where the showrunner said, just because our show looks like it's fun to write doesn't mean it's fun to write. And you're like, okay. I know what that means. And at this stage, I'm at the place where I can pick and choose a little bit. Baby writers can't so much. Just take any job.
Great. Well, I think we'll... Yeah, okay, I'll get right on that. I think we'll wrap things up. Let's give Jane a big round of applause.
Thank you. This is great. Those are great questions. Thank you. Those were some unusual questions. I liked them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really...